Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Chief Antonio Guterres is deeply concerned after Uganda's president signed into law a punitive so-called anti-homosexuality act, the UN spokesperson said on Tuesday. The draconian law foresees the application of the death penalty and long prison sentences for consensual sex between adults. Mr. Guterres called on Uganda to fully respect its international human rights obligations, in particular the principle of non-discrimination and the respect for personal privacy, irrespective of sexual orientation and gender identity. He also called on all members states to end the criminalization of consensual same-sex relations. According to the joint UN program on HIV/AIDS, such criminalization continues in 67 countries around the world, with 10 still imposing the death penalty. Just last week, the UN rights chief Volker Turk said that anti-LGBTQI laws like Uganda's drive people against one another, leave people behind, and undermine development. Soaring debt levels compounded by high inflation and rising interest rates have dashed job seekers' hopes in developing countries, the International Labour Organization, ILO, warned on Wednesday. The agency's new research shows that while in high-income countries only 8.2% of people willing to work are jobless, that number rises to over 21% in low-income countries, or one in every five people. Low-income countries in debt distress are worst affected, with more than one in four who want to work unable to secure employment. Those countries also lack the means to invest in essential social safety nets. Here's ILO's Assistant Director General for Jobs and Social Protection, Mia Seppo.
We need to create fiscal space for social investment in low-income countries. This should be considered with urgency as part of the ongoing global discussion on the reform of the international financial architecture.
The agency said that boosting social protection and expanding old-age pensions would increase gross domestic product per capita in low- and middle-income countries by close to 15% over a decade, proving that social investment makes economic sense. Staying with the world of work, Bangladesh must move away from an economy that's overly reliant on low wages as it approaches its expected transition from least developed country, or LDC, status. That's the message from UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Olivier de Schutter. Following his visit to Bangladesh, Mr. de Schutter, who is an independent UN-appointed rights expert, said that a country's comparative advantage cannot lie in keeping its people poor. He urged the government to use its upcoming graduation from LDC status in 2026 as an opportunity to rethink its dependency on the ready-made garment industry, characterized by cheap labor, which employs 4 million workers and accounts for 82% of the country's export revenue. According to Mr. de Schutter, steps towards a rights-based sustainable development included fair wages, educating and training workers, and improving social protection. Such reforms would strengthen Bangladesh's economy and allow it to develop domestic demand instead of relying mainly on exploitative export opportunities. LDCs are low-income countries facing severe structural obstacles to sustainable development, which have exclusive access to certain international support measures. There are currently 46 countries on the list of LDCs, which is reviewed every 3 years by the UN's Committee for Development Policy. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Blog Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You've felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to
Radio Free Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County.
That's an old opening. That's an old opening. I sort of forgot how weird that opening was. Hey, all things pass, you know what I mean? Well, we got a great day ahead of us. It's going to be sort of a hot one out here in northeast Kansas. 88 degrees is the projected high today. And of course, after 3 days of inundating rains, it's going to be awfully humid, man. I'll be right back with you. Don't forget, we've got the second hour, we have a new, brand new Naomi Fowler as host. That only comes out once a month. And this one came out the day last week that I played the last one of the month. So we have a brand new in the second hour. And yes, we're lucky. You're lucky for your lunchtime listening. The latest of Democracy Now! Top headlines.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives has approved legislation to suspend the debt ceiling just days before the U.S. is set to run out of money to pay its bills. Wednesday's vote was 314 to 117, with a majority of House Democrats voting in favor. If it's approved by the Senate, the legislation will cap domestic spending below the current rate of inflation while allowing larger increases to the military budget. House Minority Whip Catherine Clark said Republicans had forced Democrats' hand.
There is no perfect negotiation when you are the victims of extortion. Nobody likes to pay a ransom note, and that's exactly what tonight's vote is.
Some Republicans voted against the deal, saying it didn't cut enough from social programs. Meanwhile, nearly 40 members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus voted no. Caucus Chair Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Washington slammed the legislation, saying it, quote, rips food assistance away from poor people and disproportionately black and brown women, pushes forward pro-corporate permitting policies and a pipeline in direct violation of the community's input, and claws back nearly 25% of the funding Democrats allocated for the IRS to go after wealthy tax cheats, unquote. The bill now heads to the Senate, which will need to act quickly to avoid a catastrophic default on U.S. debts before a June 5th deadline set by the Treasury Department. In Sudan, at least 19 people were killed, more than 100 injured, as shells fired from a tank hit a market in a neighborhood south of Khartoum. The deadly violence came after Sudan's army said it was abandoning U.S. and Saudi-brokered ceasefire talks with the rival Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group. On Wednesday, the UN's World Food Program said aid workers had been able to reach civilians in the Khartoum metropolitan area for the first time since fighting broke out April 15th. The WFP says Sudan's conflict could increase the number of people facing food insecurity by about 2.5 million in the coming months. Ukrainian officials say Russian airstrikes on Kyiv overnight killed three people, including a mother and her 11-year-old daughter. Those attacks came as pro-Russia officials said five people had been killed by artillery fire in a Russian-occupied village in eastern Ukraine. Russia also said Ukrainian drones struck two oil refineries near Russia's biggest oil export terminals, triggering a large fire at one of the sites. In Washington, D.C., White House spokesperson John Kirby announced the Biden administration is sending Ukraine an additional $300 million in military equipment, including more Patriot air defense systems, anti-aircraft Stinger missiles, and ammunition. North Korea has failed in its first attempt to put a spy satellite into orbit. On Wednesday, a North Korean rocket crashed into the sea west of South Korea after its second stage reportedly lost thrust. Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of leader Kim Jong-un, said afterwards North Korea would attempt more satellite launches. The rocket's launch triggered air raid sirens in South Korea and Japan. In Seoul, a presidential alert sent to all mobile phones warned 10 million citizens to prepare to evacuate, triggering panic. Seoul's mayor later defended the alert.
This emergency message could be a working level official's overreaction, but it was not a mistake. Our principle is to respond in a manner that can be seen as excessive, and there can be no compromise on safety.
The Tokyo Electric Power Company is facing mounting opposition over its plans to pump 1.3 million tons of contaminated wastewater from the Fukushima nuclear power plant into the sea. The water contains dangerous radionuclides from the 2011 meltdown of three reactors at the site, triggered by a massive earthquake and tsunami. This week, the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency signed off on the planned release of wastewater by the plant's operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company. The plan has triggered protests in Japan and in South Korea, where anti-nuclear activists recently staged demonstrations.
I can't believe that the Japanese government's plan to release nuclear contaminated water has gone as far as it has. The impact on our oceans and the rest of the Pacific Rim will be enormous. So I think South Korea and the neighboring countries should work together to postpone the decision on nuclear polluted water discharge.
In Tennessee, a 32-year-old woman has received an emergency hysterectomy after doctors initially refused to provide an abortion to end her high-risk pregnancy. The surgery left Maren Hollis unable to bear more children. Hollis was finally granted surgery nearly a week after she was first admitted to a Tennessee hospital for excessive bleeding. She only survived after receiving a large transfusion of blood. Tennessee law criminalizes performing an abortion as a felony punishable by up to 15 years in prison, with only a narrow exception for medical emergencies. Meanwhile, the Biden administration says it's reconsidering a plan to move the headquarters of the U.S. Space Command to Alabama, citing the state's near-total ban on abortion. In response, Republican lawmakers from Alabama threatened to freeze federal spending on Space Command's temporary headquarters in Colorado Springs. In news from Georgia, a police SWAT team raided a home in Atlanta Wednesday and arrested three organizers with the Atlanta Solidarity Fund. The nonprofit group has been raising money to bail out protesters opposed to the construction of a massive police training facility known as Cop City. Lawyers have described the raids and arrests on the bail fund as unprecedented. On Wednesday, Kamau Franklin with the group Community Movement Builders spoke at a rally outside the DeKalb County Jail.
We will not be intimidated. No, we will not be stopped.
No, we
will not be out-organized.
No.
We will not let them time and time again take the only thing that they have at their disposal, which is the brutal nature of their police force, tearing themselves on us to stop us. We will fight back here in the city of Atlanta. We will fight back in the state of Georgia. We will call our caravans and organizers to come all the way across the country five more times.
The raid on the bail fund comes as 42 activists face domestic terrorism charges for opposing Cop City. The Atlanta City Council is expected to hold a key vote on Cop City on June 5th. The city recently admitted the public cost of the project will top $67 million, twice as high as originally stated. To see all our interviews with activists about Cop City, go to democracynow.org. A jury in Los Angeles has found actor Danny Masterson guilty of raping two women he met through the Church of Scientology. The jury hung on a third rape charge. Witnesses testified during the trial. Officials in the Church of Scientology pressured them not to talk to police about the rape allegations. Masterson is best known for his starring role in the sitcom That 70s Show. He faces 30 years to life in prison at a sentencing hearing scheduled for August. NASA has held its first public meeting of a panel studying unidentified aerial phenomena, commonly known as UFOs. The 16-member panel said Wednesday more high-quality data is needed to explain many of the sightings, but that there's no evidence any of them could be explained by extraterrestrial origins. Wednesday's event at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., came after Congress last year held its first hearings on the subject in over half a century. The 2024 field of Republican presidential candidates is expected to soon grow. Former Vice President Mike Pence, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum are all expected to formally launch campaigns next week. Many political analysts say the crowded field could help increase Donald Trump's chances of securing the Republican nomination again. And here in New York, the elected student commencement speaker at the City University of New York School of Law is facing death threats after she criticized the Israeli government's treatment of Palestinians during her speech. Fatima Mohammed, who is Yemeni-American, addressed the CUNY Law School's graduating class in early May after being elected to speak by her classmates.
Israel continues to indiscriminately rain bullets and bombs on worshipers, murdering the old, the young, attacking even funerals and graveyards as it encourages lynch mobs to target Palestinian homes and businesses, as it imprisons its children, as it continues its project of settler colonialism, expelling Palestinians from their homes.
Fatima Mohammed also spoke out against white supremacy and the New York Police Department. She's since faced a torrent of criticism from the New York Post and other right-wing media outlets and Republican politicians, as well as some Democrats, including Congressmember Richie Torres and New York City Mayor Eric Adams. On Tuesday, more than 2 weeks after Mohammed spoke, the CUNY Board of Trustees and the Chancellor responded to the criticism by declaring Mohammed's remarks to be a form of, quote, hate speech. However, Mohammed has received public support from the Jewish Law Students Association at CUNY and other groups. The New York City chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace issued a statement saying, quote, "We decry the false characterization of her speech as anti-Semitic simply because she accurately describes the conditions Palestinians live under every day," they said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
That was the end of this morning's broadcast of Top Headlines at Democracy Now! Coming up tomorrow at noon, following that broadcast,
for radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
That's right, tomorrow at noon, and followed in the second hour on Friday, This Way Out, a global news magazine, audio, of course, news magazine on the LGBT worldwide movement. Good to have it back. And now, coming up, our feature presentation, Law and Disorder.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with writer Michelle Mushabek about the 75th anniversary of al-Nakba.
Michelle tells our listeners about the ongoing atrocities in the occupied Palestinian territory that we really don't hear much about in the corporate media.
We talk about a military training program right in our own backyard. It's called the Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, or JROTC, and it teaches lessons to more than 500,000 students in approximately 3,400 high schools nationwide.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. On May 15th, Palestinians marked the 75th anniversary of al-Nakba, which means the catastrophe in Arabic. On that date in 1948, Israelis ethnically cleansed nearly 750,000 Palestinians from their lands and destroyed more than 500 Palestinian towns and villages. In addition, on May 15th, for the first time ever, the United Nations General Assembly officially condemned the Nakba. May 15th was also the day that Israel and Palestinian Islamic Jihad agreed to a ceasefire brokered by Egypt to stop the violence that resulted in the deaths of 33 Palestinians and 2 Israelis. The Israeli assault on Gaza was the 6th such attack since 2007, when Israel imposed a permanent siege on Gaza, controlling the ingress and egress of Palestinians. Israel maintains an illegal occupation of Palestinian territory, and the United States enables this occupation by providing $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel every year. We are fortunate to have with us today Michel Mushabik, who is a Palestinian-American writer, editor, translator, and musician. He is the founder and publisher of Interlink Publishing, a 36-year-old Massachusetts-based independent publishing house. Michel wrote the article titled, "The Nakba Didn't End in 1948. It Continues to Impact Palestinians Daily," which was recently published by Truthout. Michel Mushabik, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you, Heidi, and thank you, Marjorie, for having me on the show. It's good to be with you.
Michel, please explain to our listeners why Palestinians continue to commemorate the Nakba. What are the conditions in the occupied Palestinian territory?
Well, let me start by saying that if someone in a pub asked me to describe my family's story in one sentence, I would say exile and starting over, exile and starting over, and exile and starting over. I would probably add a clarification that I did not repeat those words 3 times because I had too many beers. But my family's experience of multiple exiles from Katamon in West Jerusalem in 1948 to East Jerusalem to Beirut to New York, it is not unique, but it's one of the many sad episodes of being Palestinians. I always tell my children that our stories of exile and displacement and injustice will live on, as will our beautiful memories of our homeland. When it comes to the Nakba on May 15, 1948, the world really witnessed one of the largest forced migrations in modern history. This date is forever etched in the collective memory of every Palestinian. And yes, the Nakba did not end in 1948. It continues to this day because of the continuation of Israel's founding strategy of the forcible removal of the indigenous population, because the horrific conditions Palestinians have to endure on a daily basis under Israel's brutal military occupation continue, because the denial of Palestinian rights to equality, freedom, and dignity also continues. My family and friends in Palestine continue to suffer daily abuses under Israel's most inhumane form of collective punishment. But, you know, worst of all, in my view, is that our government remains tacitly supportive of Israel's human rights violations, its crimes against humanity, and its ongoing oppression of Palestinians. You asked about the conditions in the occupied territories. I can tell you that the level of Palestinian despair is really at an all-time high. Palestinians continue to be colonized. Their lands continue to be confiscated for illegal settlement building. Family members continue to be separated from one another by the so-called monstrosity called the separation wall. Communities continue to be forcibly displaced, homes demolished. Palestinian farmers' olive trees, continue to be uprooted. Palestinian children continue to be terrorized and killed by Israeli defense forces. And I can go on and on. You know, even Palestinians living inside Israel and are supposed to be Israeli citizens continue to be discriminated against. And all this takes place under the watchful eye of Israel's greatest ally, the United States. So to sum up, I just want to say that Palestinians are fighting, what they're fighting for is a just and democratic society that benefits everyone. So until Palestinians get justice, freedom, and equal rights, and until Israel adheres to international law, there can be no hope for peace. And by the way, we're not going away.
Michelle, you write that Israel maintains an apartheid regime. Can you please elaborate?
Yes, sure. Apartheid is racism at its core. It's a harsh, institutionalized system of racial segregation with policies that privilege one people over another. And in Israel, non-Jews do not have the same political and economic rights as Jews. Israel controls the area between the Jordan River and to the Mediterranean Sea, and yet half the people living under Israeli control are denied equal rights. They have no say in how they want to be governed. And international human rights organizations, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, have issued extensive reports recently that concluded that Israel practices apartheid. Even B'Tselem, Israel's oldest human rights organization, recently said that Israel is not a democracy that has a temporary occupation attached to it. It is one regime between the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, and we must look at the full picture and see it for what it is, apartheid. And also the International Criminal Court labeled apartheid as a crime against humanity. Yet our elected officials, of course, disregard all of this.
Michelle, Israel justifies its repeated assaults on Gaza by claiming that it is acting in self-defense. Why is that an impermissible characterization?
Yes, we hear that all the time. You know, Israel does not really exercise its so-called right to self-defense when it bombs Gaza repeatedly, as some of our elected officials and the mainstream media outlets would have you believe. Israel commits mass murder and war crimes when it does that. It utilizes its military might, one of the world's most powerful and dangerously equipped army, air force, and navy, against an occupied, crowded population under a suffocating siege for over 15 years. And we Palestinians, we wonder and we ask, why hasn't the U.S. shown us the same empathy, compassion, and support and resolve that it has shown our brothers and sisters in Ukraine during their struggle to end their illegal occupation of their land? I am really very troubled by the fact that many fellow progressives, even, who speak up against the Russian occupation of Ukraine and other injustices, continue the tradition of silence when it comes to Israel.
Under a General Assembly resolution, the occupied people have a right to resist an illegal occupation.
You are absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely.
Michelle, in your article, you quote your friend in Gaza who told you, quote, "What is worse than dying in Gaza is living in Gaza." What did he mean by that?
You know, the situation in Gaza is so heartbreaking. Gaza has been called the world's largest open-air prison, and there are nearly 2 million people in Gaza, mostly refugees from 1948 and 1967. And as you mentioned in your introduction, Gaza has been under siege for over 15 years. And during this period, Israel bombed Gaza 8 times. and each time causing death, destruction, and a human tragedy of unimaginable proportion. The people of Gaza live their lives in daily fear of the next round of aerial bombardment and missiles that could rain on them from the sky at any time and destroy their homes and rip their families apart. This is really a historic injustice and must be stopped. We cannot really remain silent about Israeli crimes that deny Palestinians the right to live as equal human beings with freedom and dignity. It's so upsetting, you know, each time Israel's indiscriminate and criminal bombardment, it ends with a short-lived ceasefire, but that, because the terror from the sky has temporarily stopped, it does not mean that the terror on the ground has ended. It is not a ceasefire when Israel continues to kill Palestinians by land, sea, and air. It's not a ceasefire when Gaza remains under siege and all crossings are closed. And it's not a ceasefire until the violence and ethnic cleansing are properly addressed and halted. The humanitarian conditions in Gaza are dire. There are shortages of food, electricity, fuel, medical supplies. All this is leaving Palestinians without life-sustaining goods and services and with endless misery and hardship. That is why my friend said to me that living in Gaza is worse than dying, because living is a slow and prolonged death. Every child in Gaza suffers from PTSD as a result.
Could you also please cite some recent atrocities that Israel committed in the occupied West Bank?
I mean, there's been systemic raids in the West Bank, on Jenin, on Nablus, and other towns that killed scores of civilians. Last year, the Israeli army shot and killed over 170 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank alone, many of whom were children, and they wounded hundreds. The most alarming thing is also settler violence against Palestinians is on the rise. According to Defense for Children International, Israeli forces and settlers killed 36 children last year across the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And I recently read a report by Amnesty International that today there are 175 permanent checkpoints and blockades supported by a biometric surveillance system in the West Bank. Israeli authorities also last year demolished 952 structures across the West Bank and had administratively detained 866 Palestinians. And it's pretty horrific.
Michelle, 1 year ago, beloved Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was assassinated by the Israeli occupying forces for reporting on Israel's illegal activities in the West Bank. Has anyone been brought to justice for her killing? And was Abu Akleh's death an isolated incident? Or do other Palestinian journalists face similar repression from Israel?
Well, of course not. No one has ever been brought to justice when a member of the IDF has killed a Palestinian, journalist or otherwise. Palestinians the world over will never forget the assassination of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh 1 year ago. Her murder by the IDF with a sniper bullet to the face while clearly wearing a press vest is shocking. You know, Abu Akleh dedicated her life to reporting the truth and exposing the horrors of the ongoing Israeli occupation. And she, in my view, she represented the best of Palestine and the best humanity has ever produced. You asked about other Palestinian journalists. Israel's systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists, the arrest of human rights defenders, and the shutting down of human rights organizations have been very well documented. A couple of weeks ago, the Committee to Protect Journalists issued a new report released to coincide with the anniversary of Abu Akleh's death. And the report found that since 2001, Israel has never charged or held anyone accountable for the killings of at least 20 journalists, 18 of whom were Palestinian.
My co-host Heidi Boghossian and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking with writer and publisher Michel Mushabek about the ongoing Nakba in Palestine. Michel, please tell our listeners about the recent attacks on Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territory. Have other UN special rapporteurs been subjected to analogous attacks for their criticism of Israel?
The UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territory, Francesca Albanese, has come under vicious attacks, including false accusations of anti-Semitism following her report highlighting Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid. But she is a strong person who does not succumb easily to intimidation or threats. And yes, she's not the only UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights to be subjected to attacks. I don't think I am wrong in saying that most former UN Special Rapporteurs have received some kind of harsh treatment. Former UN Special Rapporteur and friend Richard Falk, for example, a prominent international lawyer and professor at Princeton University, was even barred by the Israeli government from entering Israel when he was UN Special Rapporteur.
It's clear that Israel now has the most right-wing anti-Palestinian government in history. You write that many people in Israel's new regime favor a, quote, out-of-state solution. What is that?
You know, the two-state solution promised to Palestinians during the Oslo Accords is no longer possible. It is dead completely because of Israel's continuous colonization and de facto annexation of Palestinian land. The chances of a one-state solution with equal citizenship rights for everyone are even slimmer, since Zionists insist on keeping Israel a Jewish state with democratic rights for Jews only. So what is left, and what many in the new extremist Israeli government are in favor of, is what I'm calling the out-of-state solution. And what I mean by that is that this is a strategy that aims to transfer Palestinians or keep oppressing them until they give up and leave to neighboring Arab countries, dispossessing them of their homeland. But Palestinians are determined to keep their struggle alive, so this too, I believe, will fail.
Michel, in 2005, Palestinian civil society issued a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and people around the world have responded, so much so that Israel considers the BDS movement an existential threat. Could you please tell our listeners what the BDS movement entails?
Sure. Inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement, the BDS movement is a nonviolent global initiative that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressure Israel to comply with international law. BDS advocates for boycotting Israeli and international companies engaged in violations of Palestinian human rights. It also calls for the divestment and has initiated many campaigns that urge banks, churches, universities, and the like to withdraw investments from the State of Israel and companies that sustain Israeli apartheid. And BDS also aims to pressure governments to fulfill their legal obligations to end Israeli apartheid by imposing sanctions. I can add that while it is really, it's hard for Palestinians to not feel helpless when they are subjected to these massive injustices for so long. They have shown tremendous resilience and are inspired by the collective support of people in the global community, and especially the many, many gains achieved by the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement known as BDS.
Although the U.S. government continues to unconditionally support Israel's illegal policies, there has been some recent pushback in the U.S. Congress. Can you please explain?
Sure. You're correct in saying that this administration, like those before it, continues to shield Israel from accountability for its violations of international law and enables its settler colonialism and apartheid by providing it with billions of dollars in military funding. Congress's really deafening silence and its fear of criticizing the Israeli government makes it complicit in the ongoing suffering of Palestinians. Congress has become Israel's top enabler of its crimes of apartheid and the main stepping stone in the Palestinians' quest for freedom, equality, and human rights. But having said this, you are also correct in saying that the discourse is changing. Our activism is working, and our representatives are beginning to listen. A recent Gallup poll concluded that now the Democrats' sympathies lie more with the Palestinians than the Israelis, 49% versus 38%. And the magnitude of global solidarity with the Palestinians shows that people, especially the younger generation, are no longer looking away. But while the discourse has changed enormously on the public level, the change has not yet been matched on the part of our elected officials. But we are definitely seeing signs of some pushback. And I can give you a few examples. Recently, Representative Betty McCollum and 16 co-sponsors have introduced a bill prohibiting Israel from using U.S. aid to detain Palestinian children, destroy Palestinian homes, or unilaterally annex Palestinian land. And this is an important bill that was introduced before, but Betty McCollum continues to reintroduce it again and again. Another example would be on May 15th, the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, Kevin McCarthy blocked Representative Rashida Tlaib from hosting an event at Capitol commemorating the Nakba. But despite McCarthy's attempt, the event went ahead anyway. It was moved to a Senate office room thanks to Senator Bernie Sanders, who was able to secure a new venue in the Senate office building where McCarthy has no jurisdiction.
Michelle, what can our listeners do to pressure the U.S. government to stop enabling the illegal Israeli occupation?
I would say don't stop the protests and don't stop putting pressure on our elected officials. You know, we must really intensify our call on Congress and the Biden administration to stop funding Israeli apartheid, racism, and oppression of Palestinians. I would also add, arm yourself with the necessary tools and information that would allow you to engage in critical thinking and informed debate and be able to argue in favor of justice and equality. Sign petitions that call for Palestinian rights to freedom and equality. But most importantly, stay informed, read the alternative press, Mondo Wise, Electronic Intifada, etc., your show, join organizations such as Jewish Voice for Peace, Adala, American Friends Service Committee, and others, and read books by Palestinians. Can I pitch a book here?
Yes, go right ahead.
I'm the publisher, as you said, at Interlink Publishing, and we have just published a book called Palestine hijacked, how Zionism forged an apartheid state from river to sea. It's a meticulously researched book about the 1948 period by Tom Suarez that I would highly recommend.
Michelle, in interest of full disclosure, Interlink, your publishing company, published my most recent book on drones and targeted killing. So thank you for that.
And Michelle, we understand that your daughter has just published a book inspired by you. What is it called and what is it about?
Yes, I'm super proud of my daughter, Hannah. Her book is called Homeland, My Father Dreams of Palestine. It was just published in March by San Francisco's Chronicle Books, and the publisher has already gone into a second printing, so I'm thrilled about that. It retells a bedtime story I used to tell my kids when they were little about my childhood in the old city of Jerusalem, about my walks with my grandfather. You know, I was 11 years old, just before the 67 war, when I last saw my grandparents. It was also the last time I saw Jerusalem. So the picture book, it has universal appeal. It's an endearing, lovely story of immigration, memory, and familial love.
Well, Michelle Mushabek, thank you so much for your inspiring and informative comments and for being with us today on Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you very much for having me, Marjorie and Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, or JROTC, is a federal program sponsored by the U.S. Armed Forces in high schools across the nation. It currently teaches its lessons to more than 500,000 students in approximately 3,400 high schools. In recent years, the military and its supporters have promoted the idea of a significant increase in the number of high schools with JROTC. One proposal even calls for expanding up to 6,000. Because of this, one nonprofit in San Diego decided it was time to examine the textbooks used in JROTC classes to see exactly what they're teaching. The Project on Youth and Non-Military Opportunities, or Project YANO, is a counter-recruitment organization founded in 1984. It released its findings of the textbooks in early July. Reviewers have backgrounds in classroom teaching or education activism, or special knowledge of subjects that JROTC claims to address, including civil rights, violence prevention, leadership methods, and world history. Reviewer team members included current and retired high school teachers, military veterans, and a documentary film producer. Joining us to talk about this report and JROTC in general is Rick Jankow, a co-founder and board member of Project YANO. Rick worked for 34 years as the organization's full-time program coordinator. He's researched and organized around the issues of military recruiting, high school, junior ROTC, and the general militarization of K-12 schools. Rick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Rick, tell us in a nutshell, what is the militarization of youth and what's wrong with it?
In basic terms, I would say it's a situation where young people are militarized by conditioning them to see military values and behavior as normal and an acceptable model for civilian society. That's done many different ways, but that's sort of the basic way I would define it. And the reason it's wrong is that the values taught by the military system emphasize obedience to authority and the use of violence to resolve conflict, which is the opposite of what we should be teaching young people if we want them to think critically and uphold democratic ideals.
Now, the Jay Rotzi website says, and I'm quoting, that it's one of the largest character development and citizenship programs for youth in the world. What promises does Jay Rotzi make to young people?
I'll list several. Realize there are problems with all of these promises, though. One thing they promise is leadership skills and values education. They promise self-discipline. They promise to teach lessons in history and social studies. They claim that it provides academic improvement for the cadets. They claim that it improves eligibility for college acceptance. They say that it will provide access to college scholarships. Those are sort of the main promises that one can hear from them.
Would you say that students who are attracted to some of those promises, do they join ROTC of their own free will most of the time?
I'm not sure how often it's voluntary. Yes, some do join because they want to be in the program. They see it as a way to advance their prospects for joining the military later on. But we've also seen plenty of evidence of schools involuntarily placing students in the program. And the reason for that is mostly because federal law requires a minimum enrollment level in order for a school to have the program. And so placing students in involuntarily is one way to meet that minimum requirement.
And let's just be clear, this is for both boys and girls in school.
That's true.
Now, why does the military and some supporters want to expand Jay Rotzi programs in high schools?
Well, I think it's mostly because of the recruitment function. They publicly will promise that JROTC is not a recruiting program. This is said by instructors in the program and school officials. But testimony in Congress has labeled it as the military's most effective in-school recruiting program. And according to the different military branches that sponsor JROTC, between 30% and 40% of students who finish multiple years in the program eventually do enter the military. And the textbooks are full of recruitment information telling students, you know, how to join the military. So it's really quite disingenuous for anybody to claim it's not a recruiting program.
And I was interested to learn and a bit surprised that JROTC instructs students on the use of weapons. Is that accurate?
It's often offered as a voluntary option. Students who join JROTC would have to choose to be on the rifle team. But marksmanship training is done with high-powered lead pellet rifles and shooting ranges that are frequently located in the schools. Some school shootings, in fact, have been carried out by current or former JROTC cadets. And in the case of the Parkland, Florida shooting, the shooter was actually a former JROTC cadet who learned his marksmanship in the JROTC program there.
Interesting that we don't hear about that in the news coverage of these mass shootings.
We hear very little of it.
Oh, Rick, tell us about Project YANO and why it formed.
It formed in 1984 to address the socioeconomic factors that make low-income youth especially vulnerable to recruitment and militarization, and also for the purpose of facilitating greater youth activism around the issues that directly affect them. And it was formed with the involvement of military veterans, where we see ourselves as sort of an educational organization that can help young people make more educated decisions about their futures. And we realize that when it comes to military recruitment, the burden falls disproportionately on low-income youth and youth of color.
Rick, have you encountered any legal issues when you do counter-recruitment and school demilitarization organizing?
Yes, there are several ways that legal issues come up. There is, for example, a legal issue around schools giving the military's aptitude test, the ASVAB, which stands for Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. Recruiters basically go to the counseling staff and convince them that they can give this free test to their students to help them evaluate their career prospects. And the test results in recruiters receiving not only contact information, but also very personal information on the students who take the test. And some schools have even made it mandatory that an entire grade of students take the test. The Federal Privacy Act that affects the release of pupil records, we believe, is violated by the test. And we wish that it could be litigated, but so far we've had no opportunity for that because we haven't really found the ideal plaintiff to file a lawsuit. But we worked with the Rutgers Center for Law and Justice to research the issue, and they produced a best practices memo that explains how the test violates privacy and is actually a nice piece for distributing to counseling staff at schools. Another issue has been junior ROTC, and what comes up there is there's a federal statute that requires disestablishment of a JROTC unit when the minimum enrollment is not met, and the minimum enrollment is 100 students or 10% of the student body. We've seen many cases of JROTC units that fall below the minimum requirement, but they continue to operate in the school. And here, where we're based in San Diego, we actually help members of the Latinx community pressure a principal into removing a unit for under-enrollment. But it took quite a bit of effort to do that. The principal just did not want to let go. We're also aware of another school in the county here that got rid of it voluntarily. And usually when that happens, the students are the ones who've actually determined that it was going to leave because they stop enrolling in it or they even boycott it. What we would like to see is activists pay attention to that and investigate enrollment numbers because they could do something similar. If they can document that the federal law has been violated when the unit is allowed to survive without having the minimum enrollment. And in fact, we worked with the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force on that issue, and the task force produced a very nice memorandum on the statute, and it's another way that students and parents and others could pursue the issue in their local school.
Was Kathy Gilbert involved in that?
She was involved to the extent of referring us to an attorney in Albuquerque, I think it was, who actually is the one who did the work.
Great. Okay. We love the Military Law Task Force. Rick, I understand that you actually advised on a lawsuit in the 1980s that resulted in establishing the right of counter-recruitment activists to have equal access to schools as do military recruiters. Can you tell us about that case?
Yes, that is the other instance where legal issues have come up, and in fact, it's probably the most frequent issue. What happened is in the early 1980s, a San Diego organization was banned from placing ads in student newspapers, and the organization went to federal court seeking an injunction. The argument they made was based on the First and 14th Amendments, and utilize the Supreme Court's government forum analysis. The organization lost at the district court level, but then appealed, and the Ninth Circuit basically reversed the district court. And the ruling held that the subject of military service is controversial in nature, not primarily economic, and that once a forum on such a controversial issue is created by a school, it must give equal access to those giving opposite views on the subject. There were, I think, a total of 5 lawsuits during the 1980s, all of which were eventually decided in favor of counter-recruitment groups. The scope of access granted differed in each case, but they all were positive results. And it turned out that the Ninth Circuit ruling established the broadest range for equal access. And we've used it to basically force school districts to grant access, and other groups have used it as well. The ACLU has cited it frequently when they have assisted organizations that have had access issues, and in most cases, by citing those case that those particular lawsuits, but especially the Ninth Circuit, a local grassroots group can prevail. And we've tried to make ourselves in Project Yano available to advise them on ways to do that. The problem with that is that there is a tendency by some groups to want to litigate again. And based on the climate, the political climate, especially in at the Supreme Court level, we would discourage further litigation anytime in the foreseeable future. The military tried to intervene in our case in San Diego. They did intervene in a case in Atlanta, and they stated that they did so primarily because then they could offer resources for appeal to the Supreme Court that a school district might not have. It turned out that they did not really help defeat groups from getting access in those cases. But they also made it clear that they're going to be looking for future similar cases and then seek to intervene in those.
The reason to discourage litigation, especially now, is that we don't want to create bad law and undo all the work that you did in the wonderful victory from the 80s.
That's exactly the point, yes.
Rick, let's turn to the recent Project Yano textbook report. I understand reviewers had several concerns. One was that the textbooks failed to acknowledge that members of the military are often sent to fight non-defensive wars of choice, frequently for the purpose of advancing U.S. economic and political power. In that instance, what false assumption about joining the military does it reinforce?
One motivation for many who enlist is the assumption that our military is only a defensive force that protects our freedoms. And the textbooks reinforce that myth with the kinds of lessons that you described, telling students basically this is how you'll be able to support freedom in your country and defend us from aggression and from enemies abroad. And it's basically reinforcing that myth that that is what you achieve when you join the military. In fact, it's not. In fact, you'll be sent to places to fight wars of aggression.
For the most part, is the material contained in these textbooks up to date? And also, do different branches of the military contribute to these books?
The most of the material is way out of date. The Army, in fact, during the last school year, was still using a 2005 version of their core textbooks for their remote learning program. And yes, every branch determines its own curriculum. They all either produce the books themselves or they hire writers and textbook publishers to create the material for them. And then sometimes they will take existing standard textbooks and customize them for JROTC. So each military branch can brand it according to their own characteristics.
I know this is a complex analysis, but how, in general, do the JROTC textbooks compare to standard school books?
Well, for one thing, standard school books don't contain entire sections teaching students how to join the military. They don't teach military values and military leadership. One of our reviewers, who's a recently retired social studies teacher, actually was able to compare the contents of a standard civics textbook with content that JROTC had borrowed from it and modified. And what she found was that there were questions that had been posed in the original standard book to encourage critical thinking by students, and those questions were turned instead into declarative statements by JROTC. So they weren't really asking students to think critically about a particular question. They were just telling them what to think.
And that dovetails with something you said earlier about JROTC instilling respect for authority as well as other qualities that are taught in the military. Did your reviewers find examples of racism in the JROTC textbooks?
Oh, yes. One textbook referred to the genocide waged against Native peoples in the U.S. and in the Americas as the quote-unquote Indian problem. It also quoted a general who called them savages. Another book quoted a U.S. admiral who used a racist stereotype aimed at Asians. He referred to the cunning of a female Viet Cong. Another book had a section on the Middle East, and it dismissively and incorrectly claimed that most, and they used the term Arabic, which is incorrect, that's a language, but the book claimed that most Arabic countries are under some form of Islamic Sharia law. And then it compared that to the many more countries that are based on the European Civil Code. There are other examples of that, especially in the treatment of Native Americans in the wars that were waged against them in the 1800s. It's not unusual. We saw some of those examples of racism and misinformation about history in a review of the books that we did back in the late 1990s. So it was not a total shock, at least to me, that we found more of that.
Are the teachers, the instructors who use these textbooks, are they part of the military, or are they the high school, part of the high school faculty?
They're both. They're employed by the school district, and the school district's required to give them all the benefits that are given to a regular teacher, but the military has to vet them, and they must be retired officers or retired commissioned officers. So that's a basic part of the statute that authorizes the JROTC program. They rarely have teaching credentials in the subjects that they're teaching other than military-related topics. And this has led to a lot of criticism and challenges from community activists, but school districts seem to be willing to look the other way when it's pointed out that these are instructors that are teaching subjects that they are not really qualified to teach. And the military actually recognized it was a potential problem for them when a few years ago they began to require at a minimum an associate arts degree, because there were JROTC instructors who had no college degree who were teaching these subjects in the classroom. So now at least they have to have an AA, but that doesn't mean that they have credentials to teach history or civics or social studies.
Rick, how is this textbook review project, how is the report going to be used in terms of organizing and for activist purposes?
Well, we have a couple of goals. One is that we want to bring it to the attention of journalists and op-ed writers who focus on education issues. And secondly, we want to offer it to activists as a possible tool they could use to challenge the establishment of new JROTC units in their local schools. It's a very daunting challenge to get rid of an existing unit, and in fact, we suggest looking for other things to do about existing units, like try to eliminate involuntary enrollment. But it is possible to challenge a proposal to bring in the program for the first time, and it can be done so by challenging whether or not the curriculum is being vetted by the school district. That is one tool the report is that could be used for that purpose.
I'm curious, do you have any anecdotal or other information about parents' knowledge of involuntary enrollment and any reactions by families?
Yes. When we joined a coalition to demand restrictions on JROTC in the San Diego Unified School District, one thing that happened as a result of that was parents were learning for the first time not only about the shooting ranges that existed in San Diego schools, but also that their students were being forced to attend the program. And we asked students and parents to describe to us their experiences when they found out their students were enrolled, and many of them didn't know that they could demand that their students be transferred out. And in some cases, they did request a transfer, and they were told at the local school site level that there's no room for them in other classes. And in particular, they were told that that this was their PE class, basically, and PE had no room for them. So parents got quite frustrated. They joined us in protests, both outside and inside the school district headquarters, and had a powerful influence over the school board. And the school board did decide, for example, to remove shooting ranges from 11 schools. The superintendent at that time issued a directive saying that students should not be allowed to enroll in JROTC without first obtaining informed consent from both the parent and the student. But what we found was that quite often parents were just shocked. They weren't really aware of what was behind the whole thing and what they could do about it.
Rick, I think that in general, this topic really screams out for more national media coverage. Most Americans would be shocked, I think, to learn about the extent of the JROTC programs and the repercussions they have.
Yeah, I think there's a particular danger that concerns me most, and that should concern not just people who are worried about the issues of war and militarism and the military-industrial complex, but it's the fact that a program like this is trying to convince students that military leadership models and values are suitable for civilian society. And that, to me, is the most dangerous feature of the military's intervention in the school system. They're trying to recruit bodies, but they're also trying to recruit minds. And they reach a lot of students who will never join the military, but who are groomed to at least think along military lines.
Good point. Rick, how can our listeners read this incredible report and learn more about Project Jano's work?
They can visit our website, which is projectjano.org. They can look us up on Facebook and Instagram. And if they check out those platforms, they can learn about some of the resources we've produced to not only help educate young people, but also to assist organizers.
Rick John Coe, it was just a pleasure to have you on to learn about JROTC and JROTC in general, but also the textbook report and the fine work of Project Jano. We want to stay in touch, and we wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate this.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And now, the latest tax cast released just a couple days ago. Thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow on Free Thought Friday.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, a Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. You can subscribe to the TaxCast there, or you can email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Let me know what you think of the show. Okay, coming up later on the TaxCast, the state of Minnesota in the United States nearly took a historic step for tax justice this month, but the lobbyists won, for now.
If you're a Big Four accounting firm or one of the major law firms that support multinational companies in their tax abuse, this is guaranteed to freak you out. What you want is to make sure that nobody ever tries it, that they feel the threat, the pressure, before they get to that decision point and they don't go ahead. You tell them everything will go wrong for you. You tell them anything.
Ah, it was so close. We're going to talk about that later. But first, the threat from monopoly power. A world where dominant multinationals get to run the world isn't a very happy place, or a very secure one, as it turns out. For such a long time, governments have been absent from taking the threat seriously and dealing with it. In the United States, what they call the antitrust movement has a long history. The Biden administration has actually been much more active in protecting people and the economy, more than any administration in decades, actually. There's a very long way to go, obviously. But everywhere, really, the threats posed to us all from monopolies just aren't that well understood. Some of the effects on our lives aren't that obvious, and really it's more accurate to call it concentrated market power, because we're talking about saturation by only a handful of companies in each sector. So what does that look like? Well, according to one estimate, we've got a problem when only four companies are getting 40% of sales. That's a market that's distorted, and it's lost its competitive character.
The increasing build-up of corporate power, the increasing concentration of corporate power over lots of different bits of our economy over many years is actually the central feature of our economic system.
This is Nick Dearden of Global Justice Now.
The four corporations have cornered the entire global market in grain. They effectively decide what gets grown and how. They decide what food we buy and at what price. They decide what we eat and indeed who doesn't eat. And you can apply that logic across the whole economy.
It sounds a bit simplistic to say this, but it seems like we have only one value, and that's the sacred right to make a profit no matter who gets hurt or killed. The climate crisis and lack of proper action is an obvious example.
Yes, you know, it's endangering our very existence on this planet. And if we're honest, you know, big business does not operate in any kind of a free market whatsoever.
It's often hard to see the era you're living through when you're in it. But we've been living through a neoliberal era for a very long time. But now it's beginning to crumble. Here's journalist Nick Shackson, formerly of the Tax Justice Network and now with the excellent Balanced Economy Project. He's speaking here at Yale University and he's describing here the kind of waking up with a hangover from the big party the night before.
The new idea was that we should stop worrying about democracy, we should stop worrying about power, we should stop worrying really about the structure of markets, and we should boil everything down, narrow everything down to consumer prices. And as long as consumers are happy, everything's great. And we should also focus on the internal efficiency of corporations. If corporations are efficient, then they're going to spread their wealth around and everything will be fine. So don't worry about these other issues. This story that was, one of the components of what many people call neoliberalism spread rapidly. It was obviously very well funded and it became the dominant narrative, and it effectively allowed for the massive consolidation that we've seen since then. Private equity firms were among the drivers of this consolidation, buying up firms all over the place and bolting them all together, but many other drivers of consolidation. And there was effectively a falling away of the state. The state decided to stand back, and this was both under Republicans and Democrats, all the way up to the Trump administration. And so you had this story that once you start picking at it, it's so obviously incoherent, so obviously wrong, but power was with it and it survived and flourished across the world, spread across the world, spread to Europe, spread to other countries, to Australia, to Asia, to lower income countries. And so we have the giants of today and there's pretty much no government anywhere has been effectively cracking down until very recently. So the new movement came along with this new story saying we need to start thinking about power again. We need to start thinking about democracy. We need to start thinking about the structure of markets. And we need to start taking down these giants and regulating with confidence again in the interest of people.
Yes. Obviously, the most recognised monopolies are easy to see because they clearly wield too much power, like Facebook, Amazon and Google. And not all monopolies are a bad thing. I mean, a well-run state healthcare monopoly that has the buying power to keep medical costs down and tackle pharmaceutical giants seems like an undeniably good thing. The National Health Service here in Britain is humanity at its very best. I've seen that for myself. And we used to have public-owned railways, public-owned water. Sadly, we lost those. But we can't say all state-owned monopolies are run in the public interest in the ways they should be. We've got creeping private sector involvement and sometimes the same extractive processes as any other dominant company. So our solutions must be about enshrining rights to essential things we all need, keeping them firmly in the non-profit sector. It's got to be also about democratising ownership and control, as well as, of course, breaking up corporate power where we need to. And it's bad, very bad. In the States, despite the Biden administration being the most active for decades in tackling these big mergers, the top 1% of corporations make 81% of all sales and they own 97% of all assets. You can check out stats like that on www.businessconcentration.com. It's pretty interesting. The biggest market players dominate our every waking hour. What we eat every day, how we travel, how we get our news and information, who we bank with. They influence what decisions our governments make, how much we pay for stuff, how much we fall short in tax revenues and the consequences of that. But if it seems like we're taking on the impossible here, we're not, as any good freedom fighter will tell you. Here's Nick Shackson again.
I've worked with the Tax Justice Network for many years. I started not quite at the very beginning, but near the beginning, and there was just a tiny group of us, and we had some demands, some policy proposals that you know, the powers, you know, everybody said, oh, that's utopian nonsense. Nobody's ever going to do that. And all of those proposals are now, to one degree or another, with many gaps, obviously, but have been accepted as mainstream policy by governments around the world. I've seen from the inside of a movement having, you know, some significant success. And, you know, we made a lot of progress, not as far as much as we want, but I mean, the whole international tax justice movement, we did achieve a lot.
That's Nick Jackson there, speaking at a recent event held by Global Justice Now called The Threat of Monopoly Capitalism. And you can't really separate monopoly power and market concentration from tax havenry and corporate secrecy. All of them have happened because we've allowed huge imbalances of power across our economies. And just like tax havens and the companies who use them, it's the same. It's all about escape, escaping things they don't like, whether it's taxes other small businesses pay, regulations, laws, accountability when things go wrong, transparency about how they operate or which politicians they're funding. Here's Nick Jackson again.
One of the things that I think is very important is that monopoly, it's like privatization. It's a form of privatization in a way, privatization of regulation, because if you get a bunch of companies together and they form a cartel, their bosses collude to rig prices or rig wages or whatever, that is subject to public regulation. That causes anti-cartel laws and rules around the world, and they can be stopped, they can be fined, they can be punished for that with public state regulation. But the alternative, and that's what all the companies have been doing instead, is just merging. They just join together. And once they're merged together, it's like a reinforced, legalized version of a cartel. And the public regulation has been pushed out. So we are seeing monopolization as a kind of privatization of regulation.
Underlying the neoliberal era and globalization was always the philosophy that markets will answer our needs and solve our problems. The pursuit of what's the cheapest, with no other consideration. The state's job is to get out of the way. But we're finding out why that philosophy is so dangerous and why markets left to their own devices can do the opposite of solving our problems. Here's Nick Dearden again.
You can take a number of different sectors and look at it and see the problems. But what was really interesting to me about the pharmaceutical example was the more I started looking into it, these pharmaceutical corporations like to say, we need these monopolies because otherwise we'd have no incentives to provide the medicines that society desperately needs. And it's a complete and utter lie. Actually, the more power they have accumulated, the less creative, the less inventive they have become. It isn't simply a matter of they make some really important medicines and then they squeeze as much profit out of it as they can. That was maybe the case in the 1960s. And 1970s. Today, it's not like that at all.
Yes, we've seen how big companies put their efforts into financialising every aspect of what they do, and that includes minimising their taxes. Pharmaceutical companies, just like in pretty much every sector, have merged to the point where in the United States, between 1995 and 2015, 60 pharmaceutical companies merged into just 10. The number of companies producing vaccines fell from 26 in 1955 to 18 in 1980 to only 4 in 2020. Do you remember that urgent chasing of COVID vaccines by different nations? This stuff left the world at a huge disadvantage dealing with COVID, especially poorer nations.
Pharmaceutical corporations are more like hedge funds. They don't invent any of the medicines. Very few of the medicines on their books. They buy out other companies that have done that research. They then sit on literal monopolies. I mean, you know, through the intellectual property, basically only that company can make this medicine for at least 20 years. And there's all sorts of ways that they try to extend that. And they squeeze as much out of it as they possibly can because they're making so much on every single sale. If you can only sell it to a few rich countries, health systems, well, that's okay. You know, and actually, the very value of these companies comes not really from how much they sell, but from the value of the intellectual property they hold and how much investors assume that's going to be worth in the years to come. So it's extraordinary, really, because this system is supposed to be all about rewarding innovation. But what it's actually done is completely hollowed out these enormous corporations. And I mean, I just looked at the amount that these corporations return to their investors through dividends and share buybacks. It way exceeds their research and development budget. Indeed, for most years, it exceeds their profit. It exceeds their net income because we live in a political system and an economic model which assumes that the market will provide. It assumes that these corporations have all the answers. We've eroded all of the institutions that would have allowed us to provide some counterbalance to this. And so when the pandemic struck, even though basically all of the research into those medicines had already been done by the public sector or small biotechs, at the end of the day, we couldn't actually produce them because we're still dependent on these tiny pipelines. And so we had to turn to Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca and say, take all the money you want, handed it over. Now, AstraZeneca behaved a bit differently, of course, but Pfizer and Moderna, I mean, sold hardly anything to the vast majority of the world. They just weren't interested. Absolutely shocking. And that's not just, it's not just morally wrong. It's stupid because as long as there were huge parts of the world unvaccinated, we were all at risk of a new, more virile and more deadly strain of the virus coming out and undermining the vaccines that we had had. But that seemed to be as of nothing to the pharmaceutical companies because, well, if the pandemic goes on longer, there's simply more money to be made. So there's no interest. It's not only that there's no interest in equitably selling the medicines the world needs and researching the medicines that all people urgently need. There's not really any interest in researching anything other than, drugs that have marginal differences on chronic diseases, because those are the most lucrative drugs.
And even if politicians in the wealthiest countries in the world don't care about equitable access to drugs at prices that aren't taking advantage of market dominance, they should care about this.
We are faced with antimicrobial resistance. Yes, we've overused antibiotics massively, but the pharmaceutical industry hasn't researched any more of these things because there's no profit in it, essentially, because they would be second, third generation antibiotics that wouldn't be used very much for the next 15, 20 years anyway. They're not going to make anything of them. Look, you just need to nationalize parts of this industry. It is simply not fit for purpose.
When you look at the logic of governments letting the biggest companies decide on supply chains based only on the bottom line, without any thought about global security, the world we've allowed corporations to build gets riskier and riskier for all of us. This is MEP and competition lawyer Stephanie Yon-Cortan speaking in Europe at an event called How Monopoly Threatens Democracy and Security.
The pandemic highlighted the EU's long-existing structural problems related to the supply of medicines and the high dependency on third-country import for certain essential and highly critical goods and materials. In the wake of pandemic, it is as if we finally found out that we were 100% dependent on third countries, such as China or India. One of the key lessons of the crisis is that there is a need to get a better grip and understanding of where Europe's current and possible future strategic dependencies lie. The notion of resilience of supply chains was already much discussed before the pandemic in the context of ensuring availability of resources necessary for the twin transitions, green and digital, of the economy and society in Europe. It became as pertinent as ever with the crisis. Now, facing this situation, it seems clear that our competition policy plays an essential role. It's one of the tools, a key one, to increase our strategic autonomy and our industrial policy that could secure supply chain. I think we are slowly moving from a naive Europe to a pragmatic and realistic one. No choice. Now, with the Russian invasion to Ukraine, we have no choice. No choice to face our dependency to Russian gas.
In the case of Russian gas, markets, and the German government didn't come out of this well either, allowed storage and pipelines to be monopolized, ignoring the obvious security threats. It ended up enhancing the dominant power of Gazprom, majority owned by Russia. It was an expensive lesson. Here's Christopher Gopal of the Global Supply Chain Center at the University of Southern California. He's speaking at the same event.
The Russia issue is huge and will cause a great deal of grief to a lot of people. But this is nothing compared to the type of impact that something over in China and Taiwan can have on us. Russia has probably 4 to 6 major leverage points by which it can disrupt supply chains, and some of them are not global. China has, just to give you one example, and when I say people are not ready for this, when we talk about the chip industry and the chip problem, what we felt in COVID was a hiccup. If the chips from China and Taiwan are blocked from coming in for any reason, those two together own about 20 to 30% of the world's production and the high-end chips. More to the point, the impact is not just on the chip industry, $100 billion or plus. Those are the primary industries. The impact goes on to the secondary industries, defense and aerospace, automobiles, heavy trucks, industrial equipment, infrastructure, all of these things, and then cascades to things like tourism, food production, traffic lights, shipping, everything else. Something like that would have enormous impact. It could bring countries to their knees. I hate to say even worse. There could be an even worse than semiconductors is pharmaceuticals. China produces, the numbers vary from place to place, but 90% of the antibiotics. A lot of the pharmaceutical chemicals, the APIs used in the production of pharmaceuticals, cortisone, all of these things, ascorbic acid. If that gets cut off, we have no pharmaceuticals. We have no antibiotics. Enough with the place comes down because of lack of semiconductors. The place comes down because we have no medications. Our PPEs and so on are built in those areas. A cut off from those areas would be calamitous.
Here's MEP Stephanie Yon-Cortan again on the better competition policy Europe needs.
If the political will is there, that's another question. Let me name a few, like, 4 main milestones. First, I think a paradigm shift in the objective of competition policy. The objective of competition policy, I think, has moved from a single perspective of maximizing the interest of consumers to a more balanced objective, particularly with regard to taking into account Europe's industrial interest. Second is the resilience. The resilience is now mentioned clearly as an objective of competition policy. And from now on, competition policy instruments will also have to take into account resilience issue for all supply chains. That's quite new. Third point is the announcement of a new competition framework, including state aid for semiconductors. I think this is a major step forward and kind of an implicit recognition that the current framework is not adequate to address the urgency of the crisis and the importance of this dependency issue. We need to multiply this approach, I think, without waiting to be paralyzed by drug, semiconductor shortage, and think about now, right now. For Europe, the vaccine crisis has shown us that being excellent in research is not enough to meet our needs. We need to know how to produce. We need the right scale and vision necessary to overcome persisting industrial weaknesses.
Big challenges. Much of them caused by markets and market domination by a few companies. But that sounds to me like many European governments are recognising that states can no longer just stand aside. And at the heart of all this has been misconceptions about competition. You hear that word all the time. But in the neoliberalist era, it moved from meaning businesses competing with each other on innovation and efficiency to competition between nations. So governments climbing over each other to cut labour rights, cut taxes, cut regulation, a race to the bottom. In the long run, that reduces real competition when it comes to creativity and diversity. Small and medium companies get crowded out, and governments just don't seem to know how to encourage anything else. And something as valuable as collaboration doesn't get a look in. But going back to the pandemic for a moment, despite all those troubles in, for example, sourcing PPE during the pandemic across the world, do you remember that? What's happened since then? Well, most countries have defaulted to relying blindly on markets. Christopher Gopal again.
From all my discussions with people in Europe, and they've been mainly companies, I have to add, not Europe as government or policy, we are going back to the old normal, the financialization of the supply chain, where we hit just-in-time inventory, lowest cost, assets going out. And for instance, one of the biggest companies in the US, in the world rather, has just announced that they're going back to China for cheap chips, not having learned any of the lessons.
This is about the corruption of markets, really. And this is about markets not working as they should.
Nick Saxon again.
I think the United States has been so lax for so many years that anything that Europe does looks good. Having said that, the record in Europe is appalling. Just for example, I was looking the other day at the merger statistics. I think they get about 15,000 mergers a year in Europe. And of those, maybe I think 300 or 400 get notified, you know, here's a merger. It's potentially going to cause competition concerns. You guys are going to have to look at it. If you look at the record of the mergers that are notified, which are mergers of potential concern, since 1990, 0.4% of those have been prohibited. Almost nothing. They just don't block mergers. So that's a sign that there's serious trouble. Anybody who looks around in Europe will know that we have a problem with big pharma, with big agriculture, with big retail, with big tech, with the big four accounting firms, with big banks. We've got the same problems. We have social democracy here in Europe that takes off some of the hardest edges of these things. But I think that whereas social democracy in Europe has been quite effective in certain areas, such as tax policy, in terms of monopolies and excessive concentrations of power, I think Europe has basically drunk the Kool-Aid. The fines that you see, several billion dollars on the tech giants, look big. You know, once you have a number of billion in there, it makes a great newspaper headline. But again, it's almost a rounding error in the actual size of the profits that these companies are making. So Europe is especially weak in this area. It's a very nuanced picture, of course. There are things positive and things you can say about Europe. But Europe is not in a position to, at the moment, spread a beneficial Brussels effect around the world in this area. We're working with Hope to spread this new story, and over time this is something that takes years to do, to shift things in Europe so that Europeans wake up and start to do. And I think Europeans are quite capable of waking up and doing things differently. I think there's a lot of questioning going on.
Nick Dearden again.
To prevent increasing concentration of capital is really important. And the problem is, I think competition regulators over the last 40 years have almost forgotten how to do that job. Although I am heartened by the fact that an antitrust activist was appointed to the head of the US central regulator regulation body, Lina Khan. And I'm even more heartened that she seems to be taking that job really seriously. And I mean, only this week, really interesting that they're challenging a pharma merger, a big pharma merger. It is not the only answer, but I think it is part of the answer. We're in an economy which is supposed to be all about, you know, promoting small businesses, and we hear this from government all the time, and it's just the opposite of the truth. In a sector I know best, the pharmaceutical sector, your only option, your best business model is, how can I get bought out by Pfizer? That's it. I mean, what kind of a balanced economy is that creating? None, obviously.
Yeah, quite. So what are the key things, would you say, to tackle market concentration, monopoly power?
I would argue three things. First of all, what Biden has already started to do, which is industrial strategy, which is using the power of the state, procurement and so on, to begin shaping the economy. The thing I want to make sure is that doesn't just become a form of corporate welfare. That doesn't just become about de-risking the kind of investment that you want. There's got to be a very clear public return. If we are putting this in, what do we expect back? And that's got to be about reshaping the way that the private sector operates. I think the second thing, obviously, is more use of alternative forms of economic unit, whether that be public sector, but also cooperatives. I mean, let's give some real competition to these behemoths and create that more balanced economy. And that's not just going to happen. That needs a framework and a plan by government. And I think third, and I know this is going to be welcome on your show, but it's financial regulation. Because the deregulation of finance is absolutely crucial to how all of this happens. I mean, two or three massive investment funds now own a significant proportion of virtually all corporations traded in London and New York. And they are driving these kind of incentives ever and ever more towards profit maximization. And that's helping this corporate concentration. It's only the big monopolies that can thrive in this kind of world. Because of financial deregulation, of course, as well, these behemoths can shift their wealth around the world and avoid taxes. Because we have such a financialized economy, as we've already talked about, you know, Big Pharma doesn't particularly make medicines that we need anymore. What its job is to maximize shareholder wealth. So financialization is for me the other side of the monopoly capitalism equation. And I think we cannot properly bring this kind of economy to heel and make it work in the public interest without controlling that and without regulating how capital can be used.
Yeah. Yes, and tax is such a strong tool for shaping markets and encouraging things that we want to see and discouraging things that we don't want to see. This comes down to the fundamentals of the purposes of tax. I mean, there's 5 R's of tax. Everyone knows the revenue R, but the repricing one is crucial here. So pricing damaging behaviour out and incentivising activity that's beneficial to the majority of us. I'll put a link to the 5 R's in the show notes, but tax fixes, just off the top of my head, there's excess profit taxes, financial transaction taxes are an obvious one, wealth taxes, windfall taxes, taxes to address the climate crisis, the list goes on. And governments just aren't using the taxes that are available to them in the public interest. Well, thank you, Nick Dearden, for joining me on the TaxCast. He's got a book coming out, by the way, all about the pharmaceutical industry later this year. It's called Pharmanomics, How Big Pharma Destroys Global Health. I'll link to that in the show notes. So let's head to Minnesota now in the United States, because there were many eyes on Minnesota this month. We had great hopes, but there was huge scaremongering by lobbyists, all because it looked like Minnesota might take a historic step in making big companies active there do worldwide combined reporting. It could have raised an estimated $600 million in extra corporate tax revenue over the next 2 years. Very sadly, the enabler professions and their arguments won the day, and the proposal was dropped from the bill. But why do they hate it so much? Here's Alex Cobham of the Tax Justice Network.
The idea of worldwide combined reporting sounds kind of technical and boring, but it's really powerful. What we're talking about is when US states decide the basis on which they're going to apply a formula to work out how much profit they should be allowed to tax from a given multinational, instead of looking at their share of the multinational's declared activity in the United States as a whole, they would look at their share of the multinational's activity globally. Now, what that means is, at a stroke, you put a pen through any profit shifting that the multinational is doing anywhere. And you're just looking at, you know, if 1% of your global sales and employment, let's say, is in Minnesota, if that's the formula that you're using, then 1% of the global profits will be taken as tax base by Minnesota. So you more or less switch to a complete unitary basis. You assess the profits at the unit of the multinational itself, and you give up on the arm's length principle that the OECD and before that the League of Nations have been defending for 100 years, even though it's become increasingly clear to everyone that it just doesn't work and that profit shifting is the only result of trying to do corporate taxation on that basis. But here's the thing. Because this is such a good idea, because it is simple and powerful and pretty difficult to cheat, there's enormous interest for the lobbyists in making sure it doesn't happen anywhere. Because if it happens in one place, whether that's one US state or one country, as soon as it becomes clear that it works, which, you know, I think there's a general confidence that it absolutely will, and that it raises significantly more revenue than trying to make arm's length pricing or anything else work, then the demonstration effect to everyone else is going to be enormous. Why wouldn't everyone just do the same thing? And of course, if everyone does the same thing, the effect is that there is no possibility of double taxation. If everyone says we're going to take our share of the global profit, then if that's done right, all global profit will be taxed precisely once and once only. No double taxation, but also no double non-taxation. So if you're a Big Four accounting firm or one of the major law firms that support multinational companies in their tax abuse, this is guaranteed to freak you out. What you want is to make sure that nobody ever tries it, that they feel the threat, the pressure, before they get to that decision point and they don't go ahead. You tell them you're going to lose all of your investment if you do this. Everything will go wrong for you. We will hang you out to dry. We will make an example of you as people who don't understand how to do corporate taxation. You tell them anything. You tell them you'll give them money for their political campaigns if they don't do it, whatever it is. Not that I'm accusing anyone here of corruption, I'm sure. But the point is, you are desperate to stop that first state, that first country trying this. And, you know, that's kind of what appears to have happened in Minnesota. We don't know the basis on which the lead Democrat who brought this all the way forward flipped at the last moment and just took it out completely. But we do know there was an enormous amount of lobbying, and we do know that that's what happened. So we don't know the basis of that decision. But you can be sure similar things will happen in each other case.
I bet. If Minnesota had passed this proposal to implement combined worldwide reporting, it could have shone the light not just for other US states to follow, but for other countries too. They could implement this too, couldn't they?
The G24 group of lower income countries brought forward a proposal, you know, not dissimilar to do that globally within the OECD inclusive framework process. And that was what pretty much demonstrated that the inclusive framework was not inclusive, because the framework group of countries agreed that that would be the work plan for the Secretariat. They would evaluate it and a couple of other options and then come back. And the Secretariat at the OECD never did that. They didn't do it because before they got there, the United States and France did a bilateral deal on a completely different approach. And then the Secretariat came back to the inclusive framework and said, hey, this is the way we're going to go instead. So it became immediately clear, this is back in 2019, that the inclusive framework was a sham. There was no inclusivity for non-OECD members, and that that type of option, even though the OECD had promised to the world to go beyond the arm's length principle in that process, they didn't mean going that far beyond, just a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit, as they're now trying in Pillar 1. And that's why the OECD process, of course, isn't going to really change the world, because they gave up on the original ambition. And again, we'll never quite be sure how much that's the result of very intense lobbying, but we know there was an enormous amount of lobbying, and we know they were pushing very hard to limit the extent to which the OECD did actually go beyond the arm's length principle. So here we are.
Here we are, yeah. So lower income countries already tried to propose something like this. combined worldwide reporting in the OECD, the not-so-inclusive OECD, which is, after all, a rich countries club. Would it be easier or harder for countries rather than a US state like Minnesota to implement this?
You know, it'll be interesting to see which is the next US state to consider this, given how much revenue it's likely to generate. For countries, though, there is a limitation, which is that most countries have a significant number of double tax treaties that probably makes it impossible to go straight to a unitary approach of this sort and simply tax your share of the global profits. Now, that doesn't mean that no one should do it. What it means is you probably want to do it in a group of like-minded countries and agree together that you will set aside these treaties. The European Union is still taking forward its BEFIT proposal, which would effectively do this within the EU, and there's a question there about whether that can be extended, as in the Minnesota proposal, to a worldwide combined reporting basis.
BEFIT, that's the EU's Business in Europe framework for income taxation. It's supposed to be a single corporate tax rule book for the EU, providing for fairer allocation of taxing rights between member states. So where do the G24 group of lower income countries go? I mean, we all know the OECD isn't the place to get what they want, so how about the United Nations?
There's also the process now around the proposal for a UN framework on international tax cooperation. We know that both the African and the Latin American and Caribbean regional discussions have included the possibility of pushing for unitary taxation, which could be done at the regional or the UN, the full global level. So in a sense, if things get blocked by some OECD member countries, for example, within the UN process, we could see regional moves to jointly, unilaterally move towards unitary taxation in this sort. So there's a lot to play for. There's a huge amount of revenue involved. In effect, the $312 billion, that's our last estimate for the annual tax revenue losses due to corporate tax abuse by multinationals, that would more or less be available to be reclaimed if countries switch to a unitary taxation basis. Bigger amounts of money in high-income countries, but a bigger share of current tax revenues in lower-income countries, so really a pretty strong incentive for everyone to make that shift. And it's only the lobbying that continues to hold that very sensible step back. This year might be the year that we see that dam start to crack, particularly within the UN process and the related discussions, whether or not this proposal starts to become more concretely possible. Minnesota might just be an early sign that this could be on the way.
Let's hope. You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. Thanks for joining me. We'll be back with you next month.